Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Well, Russian troops are gathering at the Ukraine border, and we're hearing plenty of revived rhetoric about the new Cold War, which got us thinking about the actual Cold War. With decades of distance, we now have more accurate details and new stories about the politics and ploys and players that kept relations between the U.S. and the Soviets on ice. None more powerful than the threat of mutually assured destruction, a far cry from the promise of the dawn of the atomic age. At that time, Albert Einstein and Marie Curie became heroes to millions around the world. Their discoveries heralded a new era of possibility for humankind. Instead, writes Craig Nelson, that sweet hope has been battered by a history of thermonuclear winter terrors and run-amok power plants. Nelson narrates that sweeping historic arc in vivid detail in The Age of Radiance, the epic rise and dramatic fall of the atomic era. And we welcome Craig Nelson to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Virginia.
Well, you write early in the book, your family is radioactive, your friends are radioactive, your pets. Really? Are we all?
Absolutely. One of the really shocking things I discovered when I first started working on this 5 years ago, if you had asked me what I thought of radioactivity, I would have said poison, cancer, infection, danger, sinister. But I also thought it was very rare and very dangerous. And then I found out it's in microwave ovens and smoke detectors. It's in Brazil nuts and bananas. It's rising up at us from uranium decaying in the bedrock. It's falling down at us from cosmic rays. It's in your pets and in your family and in your friends, and it's in you.
Well, those who had discovered this long before you, many of these names that we've heard or that are in the book, Robert Oppenheimer, Edward Teller, Curtis LeMay, but few have heard the name of a Polish girl named Mania Skłodowska. How do you pronounce it?
Skłodowska. Uh-huh.
Named Mania Skłodowska. Tell us a little bit about the life of this woman who was instrumental to the atomic age.
Once upon a time, there was a little girl named Mania who was the youngest of a family of five, a family that had once been prosperous but had fallen on hard times. And Mania's older sister, Branya, said, "You know, I have an idea. How about if I go to school and you support me for 2 years, and then I'll turn around and return the favor for you?" And this was an especially wild idea at the time because it was illegal for women to be educated past about the age of 12 where these people lived. And both Mania and her sister Branya got around this by attending something called the Floating University, which floated so the authorities couldn't track down who was running them and throw them into a labor camp. But the Floating University did a great job. Branya got accepted into the Sorbonne, the University of Paris Medical School, and off she went to Paris. And Mania went off to work as a nanny. She's now 17 years old. And she ends up working with a fantastic family called the Zarovskis. And they run a sugar beet plantation about 70 kilometers outside Warsaw. And the children love her. And it's a beautiful, beautiful home where she lives. And then the oldest Zarovsky son, Kazimir, comes home from school. And he and Mania fall head over heels in love. And after a year of romance, he tells her, "We are going to get married. I'm going to tell my parents." The parents say, "No, you're not marrying this penniless little nobody. You're marrying someone of your station or better." And they turn him down. So he and Mania keep seeing each other secretly, and he tells her, "Oh, I'll talk my parents into it. Don't worry. Wait for me." And then they find out about it, the parents, and they fire her. And Mania has to go back to Warsaw and live with her father. And she's just crushed. She's just heartbroken. She's 19. The great love of her life has been taken from her. And then the letter from Branya arrives. "I'm done with school. I'm engaged to be married. And now it's your turn. Come to Paris." But she can't go because she's so in love with Kazimir. And then a letter from him arrives. "It's never going to work out. Forget it. My parents will never say yes." So off she goes to Paris. Decades later, Kazimir would become a famous mathematician, and he would be seen frequently gazing up in the main square of Warsaw at the enormous statue of the national hero of Poland, Marie Curie, which is who Mania grew up to be.
The jilted Mania went on to study in Paris and marry Pierre Curie, who together they were praised for the greatest find in history. That was in 1903. Now, there's a passage in the book where you write about her being just enthralled with the glow of her experiments kept in jars. Since you told told that story so beautifully. I'd love you to paint the picture of Marie Curie tending her little radiated jars.
Well, it's a beautiful image because on the one hand, let's back up just a little bit. Marie and Pierre, one of the great stories in this book is the fact that almost everyone who becomes a great hero of science starts off as nobodies in the middle of nowhere, including the discoverer of the X-ray, Röntgen. And now Marie and Pierre are working in a hut that had previously been used by the community college medical school to teach its students how to dissect cadavers. They get a ton of ore from Bohemia donated, of pitchblende ore. And they find out there's something even more powerful in that ore than uranium. They basically run a chemical composition factory to get whatever is in there out. And they discover radium and polonium, named for Poland. And radium becomes an incredible craze. Many of us remember glow-in-the-dark watches and glow-in-the-dark paint and glow-in-the-dark instruments on planes, all of which were painted with radium. But probably one of the most beautiful images in the book is that Marie would go to her lab first thing in the morning before the sun came up, and she would leave out all of her radium in jars, and she said it was like aquatic fireflies glowing in the light. She just marveled at it. She couldn't stop looking at it. But then some friends did notice that after she put the radium away, the walls were still glowing.
So this beautiful element, which you call in the book the two-faced god, irrational yet powerful, yet destructive, yet so promising. Can you explain what radioactivity is that contains such conflicting capacities for progress and for destruction?
Well, the fundamental issue about radioactivity is that it's these little chubby, morbidly obese atoms. And they're atoms that are so fat that they break the laws of attraction that create our material world and spit out little pieces of themselves. They spit out two kinds of subatomic particles and a stream of energy called a gamma ray, which is like a super X-ray. And all of that means, though, that what you have is you have these minerals and metals that are spewing out invisible energy. So in a way, it's sort of like they're alive. And in fact, when you hold a piece of silvery plutonium in your hand, it's warm like a puppy. But then at the same time, at Los Alamos, the medical solution for holding the puppy too long in your hand was called high amputation. So you have this thing that's sort of somewhere between the living and the dead, and I think it's disturbing to many people. I frankly like it, but I think it is disturbing to many people, and that's our fundamental fear of radioactivity. How can something that seems to be alive come out of matter? And that's why we call the dissolution of radiation over time a half-life. It's not a life, it's a half-life.
We're speaking with Craig Nelson about the age of radiance, the atomic age that began in the late 19th century and really dominated the 20th century. Craig Nelson says it is now in its twilight. The development of nuclear physics from that point with Marie Curie and then carried on by Fermi and Szilard, is that how I say his name?
Leo, yes, you can say Szilard or Szilard. Almost everyone in this book wanted to become American, so we can pronounce them with as American accent as we want.
Well, this development of nuclear physics and energy running in parallel with geopolitics of the time. So what kind of political forces were shaping the development back in those very early days when Enrico Fermi and Leo Szilard built the first nuclear reactor, by the way, speaking of the cadaver hut, in a squash court.
Exactly.
Court at the University of Chicago.
Exactly. So the astonishing thing about all of this that I discovered was that in 1941, when fission is discovered, everyone in America hears the idea of splitting the nucleus of an atom as a source of bombs and power and thinks it's crackerjacks. The American physicists are all working on radar. And when they start hearing these nuclear physicists start talking about this idea, they think they're out of their minds. But the nuclear physicists who are working on it are all refugees from Europe, and they are consumed with one idea: what if Hitler got an atomic bomb? And this literally drives the entire Manhattan Project from start to finish: what if Hitler had an atomic bomb? So one of the things that I thought was very interesting in researching this book is that I think the generally educated public, when they hear the story of Los Alamos, basically it's told to us that, you know, Einstein and Oppenheimer wrote some equations on a board and then voila, bombed. Mm-hmm. But in fact, a number of the most dangerous experiments in the history of American science took place to make those bombs. And the first one was the first nuclear reactor. There was a strike at the building that the first nuclear reactor was supposed to be in, the Argonne Forest outside Chicago. So the University of Chicago said, well, we have this abandoned football stadium since we've given up football, and inside there's this squash court we aren't using. What about that? And they said, okay, let's do this. So what I think is just terrifying is that the very first nuclear reactor to ever work ever was built in the middle of the city of Chicago, where you can imagine many terrible things happening, but the guy who did it, Enrico Fermi, was so meticulous and such a good researcher that it went off without an error. But there is a very funny postscript to this story. The Soviet spies who were sending information back to Moscow, there is a mix-up in translation. So for almost 40 years, the Soviets thought the first nuclear reactor was born not in a squash court, but in a pumpkin patch.
Well, these are just the wonderful details that you bring to life in this book, and there are so many personalities and so many stories and glimpses into human frailties. But one of the things I see here that's part of what you write about is this beauty of discovery, this kind of vivid possibility of discovery. And now you're seeing the nuclear era in its twilight. Did it get ruined along the way by all of the destruction at Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Chernobyl, Fukushima?
Absolutely. I like to say that Americans first learned about nuclear science when they saw pictures of the victims of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and that's been associated with everything nuclear ever since. And then we learned about nuclear power from a funny coincidence, which is that when the meltdown happened in Three Mile Island, the Jane Fonda movie China Syndrome was playing at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So our entire image of nuclear science and nuclear power stems from these horrors, and that's the immediate reaction we have to everything is tinged by those two ideas. What I think the reason why I think we're in the twilight years of nuclear power is that every single time there's an accident, could the authorities and both the industry and government do a worse job? I mean, really, they really could not do a worse job.
Well,
than
your
do.
Account of Fukushima just shows that. I mean, I think there are many Americans that have the impression that there are Homer Simpsons running our nuclear power plants.
They are right. There are Homer Simpsons
power. So the point, of course, is it's not the power itself. It's the people who are running it and regulating it and making a lot of money off of it in some cases.
And how they react to these accidents, you know, to have immediately the government and industry in charge of a nuclear accident clamp down and be less than transparent and be less than forthcoming and withhold data and mislead people. It happens again and again and again. The great irony about Three Mile Island is that the safety features of American nuclear reactors worked in that instance. No one was ever harmed because of Three Mile Island. But everyone in America thinks it was this horrible tragedy, a big disaster. So the government and the industry in that case blew that too.
Well, it is hard to reckon, Craig Nelson. You write devastating descriptions of the human and environmental costs at Chernobyl and at Fukushima. And then you argue that nuclear power is the most environmentally viable option for energy. I'm just trying to reckon those two, and it sounds like you've struggled with that yourself.
Well, it is a struggle because, you know, first of all, we just have reports that air pollution is entering California from China. So their use of coal has gotten so over the top that their air pollution is now being exported back to the west coast of the United States. So while everyone is asking me as I do these interviews, what about the pollution from Fukushima? I say, well, you need to start worrying more about coal. 16,000 Americans die every year from the pollution caused by using coal to produce electricity. And petroleum is not much better, even if you don't care about greenhouse gases in the future. And then, you know, natural gas would be great if it wasn't for fracking. So to say that we should have no nuclear ever because of these three accidents, when you compare it to these other things, it's not so terrible.
Are you sad to lose the atomic age? I mean, there is a part of me that senses a kind of nostalgia and wonder about it.
The terrible sadness is the fact that a great number of tests were done at Nevada and in the Pacific with all these various bombs. That data could have been helpful to come up with better nuclear technology that people considered to be safe and that was economically viable. But instead, all of that data is classified. So the United States has totally contaminated the state of Nevada. And in fact, those Nevada test site bombs have totally contaminated the continental United States, with 11,000 Americans dying from that pollution every year. But we aren't able to use that data for anything good because it's still classified even though it's 60 years old. So that to me is tragic.
Craig Nelson's new book is called The Age of Radiance, The Epic Rise and Dramatic Fall of the Atomic Era. What a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Virginia. It's been great.
You'll find much more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org.